This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyis Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's like when you say you are going to arrest the president of the U.S. No one will arrest the president of the U.S. Nowhere in the world will they ever be arrested.
That's Obed Bapela, a senior member of South Africa's cabinet, on the difficulties of arresting world leaders such as Russian President Vladimir Putin, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court. Details coming up. Also, fighting continues in Sudan despite a new ceasefire. And Malawi is appealing for $700 million in help to rebuild after Cyclone Freddy. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Heavy fighting was reported today in Sudan's capital, Khartoum, despite the latest ceasefire declarations and appeals from the UN for a truce. Michael Atit reports from Port Sudan, Sudan.
Fighting resumed early morning in Khartoum between Sudan's military and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, despite a one-week truce announced by both parties, which had been expected to commence today. Eyewitnesses say smoke could be seen over the presidential palace in Khartoum and around the other military base in Khartoum North or Bahri due to heavy strikes and bombardment. UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths arrived in Sudan late Wednesday to assess the situation. Griffiths called for a genuine ceasefire to allow humanitarian aid workers to reach people affected by the fighting. Sudan's health ministry says more than 500 people have been killed and nearly 5,000 wounded since the military and RSF began hostilities on October the 15th. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan said this week that at least 334,000 people have been internally displaced by the fighting and about 100,000 have fled the country. The office said in a statement that several neighborhoods in Khartoum continue to face water shortages in addition to blockouts and lack of fuel. Michael Atit for VOA News, Port Sudan.
U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order today that allows sanctions against individuals or groups responsible for threatening security and peace in Sudan, as well as those who undermine a civilian democratic government or commit human rights abuses. The order appears to be as flexible as possible. It does not name anyone specifically, just lays out broad parameters for punishable actions. Fighting began almost 3 weeks ago, and efforts to forge a lasting ceasefire have been shredded by continued fighting between the army, led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, headed by General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. In a statement, Biden called the fighting unconscionable and a betrayal of the Sudanese people's clear demand for a civilian government and a transition to democracy. Sudan's warring military factions agreed in principle to a 7-day ceasefire starting today, but like other tentative truces that have been undermined by rampant violations, heavy fighting was reported in the capital, Khartoum. The fighting is between the two generals. In part two of an exclusive interview, former Sudanese ambassador to the U.S., Kadir Haroun, shared with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi what he thinks is the best way to end the conflict.
The best way that the regional and the international community should encourage and allow Sudanese of different walks of life, of different orientation, to sit together and try to come to a formula that will enable them to hold a free and fair election. They could seek some help from their African brothers through the AU, or from their Arab brothers through the Arab League in Cairo. This is possible. If they need help, they seek it first of all from their brother and sister in Africa rather than from the former colonial rule, which there is a great suspicions among Sudanese people from their intervention in this situation, and their intervention led, unfortunately, to these clashes, this killing in Sudan.
So what role do you see for the United States in pushing for a peaceful settlement of the Sudanese conflict?
The United States of America was successful once when they bring the former government and the former rebel of South Sudan, Dr. John Garang, together. They stayed for 3 years and they were able to stop the civil war between the North and the South. The best thing to do, the United States, is to encourage all Sudanese people, no exclusion for any party or for any group, to sit together and try to find a way to hold an election as quickly as possible. This is, I perceive, the only way out of this. You cannot force among Sudanese, an independent country, a member of the United Nations, you cannot impose themselves a hand-picked individuals, and you call it civilian law. There is no civilian rules without election. If you are going to impose a civilian, this is just like imposing a military in camouflage to rule the country. So if you are really faithful about democracy, if you would like to spread democracy throughout the world, let the Sudanese people choose their government like any decent people around the world. This is the role of the leader of the free world, the United States of America, in my opinion.
Do you see any future for either Al-Burhan or Hameti in the political elite in Sudan?
I don't think that Hameti in particular would have any future in Sudan, because he now declared by the de facto government of General Burhan as a rebel. And he canceled him as rebel support forces. He said there is no rebel support forces. Burhan should quickly try to discuss with other Sudanese how to hold an election, and he should go very quickly if the Sudanese people elected their government. I don't think that he has a future in Sudan as a leader. The future of Sudan is through democracy, is through the ballot, and this should be the way for our country.
What Hameti supporters in Darfur, would that pose a threat of divisioning Sudan, partitioning Sudan?
Hameti is not enjoying that full, because we have the leader of his tribe, Rizegat. They announced that they are supporting the National Sudanese Army. They are not agree with him in fighting against the government. And there is no one country in the world which has two armies. If they ask him to integrate into the army, he refused that. So I don't think that he is going to pose any threat, because his people, as they declare it widely, loudly, that he should surrender and he should stop this war, which brought many people from neighboring countries to fight for him in Sudan. And in Darfur, there is only one state, which is Western Darfur, which has been fighting for the last 3 years between his tribes, between his RSF and with an African tribe called Masalid there. This is something quite different. So I don't think that he will have any future in the politics of Sudan from now on.
That was Sudan's former ambassador to the U.S., Kadir Haroun, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. The World Food Program's director for Eastern Africa, Michael Dunford, says the UN agency is restarting emergency assistance in parts of Sudan, but has not yet positioned food and other supplies in the capital, Khartoum, where fighting between competing military forces is in its third week. Dunford tells VOA's Carol Van Dam the WFP will return to Khartoum as soon as it can, but the overriding concern now is the hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing to 7 neighboring countries.
We will be in Khartoum as soon as we possibly can be. We've still got national staff who have remained behind. We have a core team of international staff in Port Sudan. We're building up our surge capacity. We will send in staff. We will send in assets. We will build up the capacity to meet the needs of what is a humanitarian crisis. Our other big concern, of course, is what implications this has for the region as a whole. You've seen refugees moving into Chad. You've seen them moving into South Sudan. These are already countries that are very fragile, where we have existing operations, we expect that what's happening inside Sudan is also going to have a negative impact on these neighbouring countries. So we're also gearing up to respond and increase our activities in those countries as well.
As you said, people were already suffering and millions needed help in South Sudan. Now you've got millions of these people just trying to get across the border. How is that going for the World Food Program when you're already helping the people in that country?
Well, it's tough because, in fact, even before this crisis, we did not have the levels of funding we needed to meet all of the people that we were targeting. We were unable to provide full rations to all of the displaced in places like South Sudan and Chad. So this is just going to make a bad situation even worse. And at the moment, I don't know where the bottom is. I don't know where this is going to end. All I know is that this is the last thing, this conflict is the last thing that the people of Sudan and the people of Eastern Africa need.
That is Michael Dunford, World Food Program Regional Director for Eastern Africa. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Senior members of the South African government have told VOA they are working hard to make it possible for Russian President Vladimir Putin to visit the country free of concern about being arrested. Putin is supposed to attend the summit of the BRICS countries in Cape Town in early August, but the International Criminal Court, the ICC, has issued an arrest warrant for him for alleged war crimes in Ukraine. As a signatory to the ICC Charter, South Africa's African National Congress ANC administration is obliged by law to execute the warrant. Darren Taylor reports.
Senior member of President Cyril Ramaphosa's cabinet, Obed Bapela, points out several countries have amended the ICC laws contained in their constitutions to allow them to act according to their own interests. He says the United Kingdom did so years ago, mainly to prevent former Prime Minister Tony Blair from ever being tried by the ICC in connection with the Iraq War.
As a result, Pinochet, the dictator of Chile, stayed in Britain and died in Britain with a warrant of arrest, and Britain never arrested him because of the statute it was domesticated. And I think the domestication is the route that will then be going as the ANC NEC took a decision on.
Bapela says it's not in South Africa's best interests to arrest the leader of a fellow BRICS member.
South Africa will never arrest Putin. It's a declaration of war, as already Dmitry Medvedev said, that any country that arrests Putin, you are declaring war on us. And it's like when you say you go and arrest the president of US, no one will arrest the president of US. Nowhere in the world will they ever be arrested.
The BRICS summit is to be held in Cape Town, which is in the Western Cape, the only province in South Africa not governed by the ANC. Western Cape Premier Alan Windey, who's a member of chief opposition party the Democratic Alliance, told a meeting on Tuesday he had a warning for Putin and the ANC.
I see the president and the ANC are flip-flopping all over the place. Now they're going to support him, then they're not going to support him, then they're going to be part of the ICC, then they're not part of the ICC. There's no flip-flopping here in the Western Cape. If Vladimir Putin comes here, our law enforcement officers will arrest him and send him to the courts.
But legal expert Mpumulelo Zikalala says Windy's mistaken if he thinks this is going to happen.
You can't say as a premier, this is what I'm going to instruct, because they do not get instructions from you. They get their instructions from the commissioner and not you as a premier. You can't effect an arrest warrant as a premier or instruct someone to go and effect it, because you simply have no powers in doing so. You are a political head of a particular province, and that's where it starts and that's where it ends.
Several government officials have told VOA that South Africa's ICC laws will be amended. But, says Zikalala, such changes would be subject to parliamentary approval. With the ANC's majority in parliament, there's no doubt they'd become law, but not before likely objections from opposition parties, which would delay the process. So the government remains concerned the ICC legislation won't be changed in time for the BRICS summit. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Malawi's president is appealing for international help to rebuild after Cyclone Freddy killed more than 1,000 people in March, saying the country needs about $700 million for the recovery initiative. The UN in Malawi says raising the funds will be a challenge amid global donor fatigue. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
Lazarus Chakwera said this week Malawi has lost $500 million to tropical cyclone Freddy, the cyclone which also affected Mozambique and Madagascar in March, hit 15 countries in southern Malawi, rendering near 700,000 people homeless.
After this emergency period has passed, our experts also estimate that the work of recovery and reconstruction will cost an additional 700 billion kwacha, funds we do not have and which are outside our recently past budget.
Chakwera says Malawi would respond to the problem like a nation under attack and not a nation under threat. Chakwera appealed for international help with rebuilding infrastructure lost to Cyclone Freddy.
This is why the state of national disaster that I declared on March 13th to call for international support remains in force, and why I will personally use a few upcoming international gatherings of world leaders to directly engage them with specific proposals on how they can support us with the daunting task we have going forward.
Chakwera left the country Wednesday for the United Kingdom, where he expected to meet world leaders during the coronation of King Charles III of Britain. Chakwera's appeal comes 2 weeks after the UN renewed a fresh appeal to humanitarian partners made in April for $70.6 million to support cyclone victims in Malawi. The UN says less than 11% was donated. The UN Resident Coordinator's Office in Malawi could not respond to the questionnaire from VOA Monday on its contribution toward cyclone recovery efforts in Malawi. However, despite funding shortfalls facing the government and its partners toward recovery efforts, the group of well-wishers in Malawi is contributing funds and building low-cost houses for poor cyclone survivors. More than 12 houses have been built in various districts hit by the cyclone under the low-cost housing initiative, which started in April. Entrepreneur Kondwani Ngwira leads the group. He told VOA the initiative started after realizing that there are many poor people who lost their homes and could not afford to find land to build their lives.
We discovered that most children have stopped going to school. Like the ones we are building this house for, they are no longer going to school. Now, as soon as we finish, they'll be able to go to school, because one cannot operate from a camp going to school. Psychologically, the person is already affected.
Ngwira said funds permitting the group plans to construct upwards of 400 low-cost houses for those displaced by Cyclone Freddy. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Zambia's opposition has criticized an agreement with Kenya to allow Kenyan farming of maize in Zambia to help meet its food needs amid a record drought. But the National Democratic Congress says Zambian farmers should be given priority for farming Zambian land for exports to Kenya. Kathy Short reports from Zambia.
The Horn of Africa's record drought has made maize a staple food in Africa, an even more sought-after grain. In Zambia, one of sub-Saharan Africa's top maize suppliers, police say the demand has fueled smuggling to neighbors like the Democratic Republic of Congo, causing shortages at home. Despite the supply concerns at home, Zambia in March signed a controversial deal with Nairobi to allow Kenyan farmers to grow maize in Zambia for export to Kenya. Saboi Mboela is leader of Zambia's opposition National Democratic Congress.
We do have a lot of farmers in this country, and the government also can empower a lot of subsistence farmers so that they grow a lot of maize and they export. Why do they have to involve Kenyans in doing that? You know, let them deal with the Zambians alone.
Kenya's High Court in April temporarily suspended the deal after the Kenyan Farmers Party argued it is unconstitutional. Another hearing is scheduled for later in May. If the agreement goes ahead as planned, some analysts argue it will benefit both Zambia and Kenya. Isaac Mwaipopo is director of Zambia's Center for Trade Policy and Development.
And that step that had been taken by the two governments was going to be a step in the right direction in terms of creating job opportunities within the continent, but also getting to deal with the food security concerns within the continent.
The Zambian government declined VOA's request for comment, but information officials provided video aired on state television that they say shows Zambia's President Hakainde Hichilema meeting with farmers, millers and grain traders in April to discuss the maize deal with Kenya.
We respect what you do. We respect what farmers do. But let's also support farmers so that they too can make money.
Both the Zambian and Kenyan Ministries of Agriculture declined VOA's request for comment on the maize farming deal. Kathy Short for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
Earlier this year, Cape Verde signed a deal with Portugal, the deal known as a debt for nature swap. Edson Mendes, the director of Renewable Energy Training Center in Cape Verde, spoke to Ricky Shryock.
We have a pipeline of projects, namely in solar technology. Now, Cape Verde has around 38.3 megawatt new projects in photovoltaic, and we have other projects regarding the wind technology. Okay, with this project, it's possible to achieve the target for the 2025. We just have two years.
What is the objective for 2025?
Is to achieve 30% of penetration of renewable energy.
Is that a rare achievement? If you are able to meet that goal,
I think no many countries. Okay.
I mean, no African country has that rate.
No. In the continent, yes, we are the first one. Okay.
And what are the main challenges when it comes to developing renewable energy resources on Cape Verde?
The main challenge is we are a 10 island and 9 inhabitants, so we have 9 small systems.
It's the disconnectedness of the grid itself that's the challenge.
Yes, it's 9 different grids, okay? If it is possible to connect even some island, okay, will be more advantage, okay? We should to invest in the renewable energy, but this investment should be financial feasible.
When you talk about financial feasibility then, and can you tell me about the recent agreement between Portugal and Cape Verde, wherein Cape Verde's debt to the state of Portugal, not the private debt, but the state debt, can be reinvested into renewable energy?
Yes, the agreement that Cape Verde signed with Portugal is because the debt, if I'm not wrong, the debt is that Cape Verde have with Portugal is around 600 millions of euros. So the idea is to use this this money for the financement of the Environment and Climate Fund. Cape Verde already have the Climate Fund. The idea is to use this money for the financement of some projects. Okay. Of course, the main objective is to finance the project in the our energy transition program that is focused on the renewable energy and electrical mobility.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.